Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
...240 hostages, including over 30 children. So we hope to get them home. We're doing everything we can to bring them home. And the less we say, the better and the more likely we will be to secure their release.
U.S. and Israeli officials say there are ongoing negotiations to help release the hostages from Hamas.
Yes, the Electoral Commission of South Africa will be registering voters across our nation Saturday and Sunday. That means it's Saturday the 18th and Sunday the 19th of November 2023.
The Electoral Commission of South Africa begins two-day voter registration.
And I believe the president-elect is going to work with President Weah. He has always proven to be someone who loves this country. And so working with him will set the stage. It will bring the two factions together.
And Liberia's former vice president and main opposition leader, Joseph Boakai, is the president-elect. We'll have a reaction. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. and Israeli officials say there are ongoing negotiations to help release the hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7. But Israeli officials refuse to give details due to what they say is the sensitive nature of the negotiations. This following report of a possible deal that will lead to the release of the hostages to their families. Meanwhile, South Africa has officially referred Israel to the International Criminal Court over allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity. This as the ruling party also backs calls for a parliamentary measure to close down the Israeli embassy in South Africa. For the latest development about the negotiations and the war between Israel and Hamas, I reach Ilion Levy via Skype. He is a spokesman for the Israeli government. Here is part one of the conversation.
I'm not going to comment live on air about sensitive negotiations. You'll understand that human lives are hanging in the balance. 240 hostages, including over 30 children, including 10 toddlers under the age of five. There's a 10-month-old baby who is now being held hostage by Hamas in a dark tunnel somewhere. So we hope to get them home. We're doing everything we can to bring them home. And the less we say, the better and the more likely we will be to secure their release.
Well, Israel says it has uncovered a Hamas command center, tunnels and ammunitions at the Shifa hospital. Some of the doctors are denying, and Hamas is also dismissing the finds. What's the Israeli government's reaction to these denials?
Look, the fact that Hamas denies it is not surprising. Hamas denies that it perpetrated the atrocities of October 7th. Hamas denies that it took civilians hostage. Hamas denies that its fighters have been killed. Hamas denies everything, okay? Hamas is not a credible source for anything. Now, as for the doctors inside the hospital, you have to understand, perhaps they're good people. I don't dispute that. But they are living under an authoritarian regime. Hamas is an authoritarian regime that dictates what people are allowed to say freely. And they know that they are not free to speak freely. And so whether or not those doctors are supporting Hamas, and the evidence shows that actually Hamas enjoys vast support among the Palestinian public, those doctors are not free to speak their minds. So the fact that they're not telling us, look, there's a Hamas compound in the basement, is not surprising. What I can confirm, we are revealing the evidence, we're exposing the evidence. This isn't the Wizard of Oz that we can pull back a curtain and say, ta-da, here is the whole vast Hamas tunnel complex. They've spent 16 years building these headquarters. They've had a month to prepare for us coming, and we will peel back the evidence and present it for the whole world to see.
Some Israelis, I'm told, are calling for the prime minister to resign because of what is going on. Are those calls legitimate, and what has been his reaction so far?
First of all, the Israeli public is right to be extremely angry about the failure that led to the October 7th massacre. This was the greatest tragedy in our country's history. And the prime minister has said that after the war, after we win this war, after Hamas is defeated, everyone is going to have to give the Israeli public answers, including him. Everyone will have to take responsibility. Everyone will be accountable. But for now, the prime minister says we're focusing on the questions that will help us prosecute and win this war. And that is the mission that we are focusing on now.
Well, Mr. Levi, there are calls by some in the international community for Israel to end its military offensive ongoing at the moment. What is Jerusalem saying about this?
In one word, no. There will be no end to the fighting that leaves our hostages in Gaza and Hamas in power. We will not go back to 6 a.m. on October 7th. We will not go back to a world in which Hamas can decide whenever it wants to invade Israel's villages, burn whole families alive, torture children in front of their parents, mutilate parents in front of their children, to rape little girls, to abduct our grandmothers, to behead babies. We will not go back to that world. There is only one way that this war can end, and that is with the total destruction of Hamas's military and governing capabilities in the Gaza Strip so that Gaza can never pose a security threat to Israel. And as for the international community, we know that we have the good nations of the world behind us. The United States stands shoulder to shoulder with us, that the goal of this war must be the total destruction of Hamas. The Prime Minister of the UK has also said the UK wants Israel to win this war because they understand that the world is only safe when terrorists know that they cannot get away with committing such barbaric atrocities, when they know that if they try to hurt populations in democratic countries, those countries will come after them and will wipe those terrorists off the face of the earth. And that's exactly what we're going to do to Hamas. We're going to hunt every single monster involved in the October 7th massacre. We will bring them to justice and we will make them pay.
Ilan Levi is a spokesperson for the Israeli government. Hamas has denied it targeted civilians to kill or kidnap them, but has said other groups might have done that. However, several governments, including the United States and independent international news outlets, have said there's ample evidence taken from Hamas fighters who were captured or killed on October 7th, confirming civilians were targeted. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation with the Israeli government spokesperson. The Electoral Commission of South Africa begins two-day voter registration to compile a list to be used for next year's general election. The process begins on Saturday and ends on Sunday. This, as the electoral body releases guidelines for the provincial and national elections in 2024. The Electoral Commission says prospective voters over 18 years old and a South African citizen can also register online on the organization's portal. For more on the voter registration, I reach Kate Bapela. She is the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of South Africa.
Yes, the Electoral Commission of South Africa will be registering voters across our nation Saturday and Sunday. That means it's Saturday the 18th and Sunday the 19th of November 2023. We open our voting stations from 8 in the morning until 17 hours. And we've got more than 70,000 deployment of workers that will be working in all our voting stations. In total, we've got 23,000 voting stations that will be opened for this particular purpose.
How many prospective voters are you targeting to register in this two-day window?
Our target for this weekend is 1 million South Africans to come into our voters' roll, especially the young ones. You know, we've got a very big youth bulge that is not coming through to the voters' roll. With the coming in of new political parties and also the law that allows independent candidates to contest the national and provincial elections, we believe that we could be able to reach this number. And besides opening our voting stations, we also have got online voter registration, which is where young people are too busy. You know how young people are busy, the whole world. Those who are busy, then they can just go online and register to become voters. They don't have to leave their place of comfort. They don't have to, all they've got to do, they just have to go into their mobile devices and then register to become a voter. So it's easy and very convenient for very busy people like our young people in South Africa.
So, okay, talk to me about efforts by the Electoral Commission of South Africa to sensitize or educate these voters in order to encourage them to register in readiness for next year's elections.
We have started already a year ago to maximize our civic and voter education, where we went to high schools, we went to tertiary institutions, we went to all sorts of NGOs, non-government organizations, which include churches, traditional leaders, farmers, business, and so many entities that we went to. But also we have deployed democracy educators who are going house to house, who are working with various institutions to ensure that our messages are going all over our country, be it urban or rural, but also what we are doing from a media point of view. We've got a massive placement of adverts which are playing very regularly. We've got civic and voter education content. We've printed quite a lot of leaflets. We've got posters, as I'm speaking to you. Our country is full of posters. We've got billboards. We've got ATM screens. We've got wall murals. And so we've got quite a lot of a plethora of platforms.
Kate, is there any role, or are the political parties playing any role in this voter registration process?
They're playing a very big role. You know, when you have new political parties, what it means is that your voters' role naturally shrinks. So there are more players and lesser voters. So therefore, most of them have printed posters. They've joined our campaign for voter registration. They've gone on their social media pages. All the big parties that are represented in government, in parliament in South Africa, you'll find them, I think about 14 of them, that they've already promoting voter registration, both on outdoor, which is your posters and other things, as well as on their social media pages. But as well, the trend that we're seeing, most of all the new parties, they are promoting their voter registration with the IEC on their social media. They've even printed posters. Mm-hmm. Maybe the other thing, Peter, that is important is that from our side as a country, we've got a device that you call voter management device, which carries all the 26 million people on our voter roll. It's residing in every voting station in our country. When you come to that voting station, they scan your ID. There comes Peter, and then it tells the presiding officer where you stay and all of those things. So it assists us to ensure that we are not having people moving across, because normally in South Africa, if you are not in a correct voting station, it's not easy for when you tally votes later, when you count the votes. But so we're ensuring that everyone is registered where they live, that's our rule, and then you vote where you are registered. So it's one of those great devices that we are bringing into these elections. I'm also going to share footage with you after we do a demonstration with our national broadcaster tomorrow morning, just to see how the device works.
Kate Bapela is the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of South Africa. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. In Malawi, the executive director of the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, or CDEDI, is calling on the government to take steps to reduce the country's debt burden. Sylvester Namiwa expressed concern that the country's debt is not sustainable, which he contends could bankrupt the Southern African nation. His remarks come after President Lazarus Chakwera announced the suspension of foreign trips for all public officials, including himself, until the end of the financial year in March 2024 as a cost-cutting measure. But Namiwa tells me that the president's effort does not go far enough to reduce the debt.
In fact, the announcement was made in what can best be described as a bragging show, that he has managed to clinch the IMF's extended credit facility that will assure him two or three flights outside the country. The so-called immediate suspension of international travels is not sincere. If it were that is sincere, today he could have been in office, but as I'm talking to you now, he's somewhere doing a job that could have been able to be done by a cabinet minister or even a principal secretary. So what we are made to believe that is cancellation of international travels is as a result of the holiday. We all know that the world is going for holiday for the festive season. But the moment the holiday is over, the president will be up in the sky traveling.
Namiwa, are you saying that the measures which the president is saying will take place until the end of the next financial year in March will not have any significant impact? Is that what you are saying?
Pure rhetoric. For example, public debts have ballooned from 9 trillion Malawi kwacha to 12 trillion. The debt levels are completely out of hand. They are unsustainable. There is no reason whatsoever that, given the economy that is on a deathbed, cannot manage to finance or sustain a 35-member cabinet. It is practical to govern this country using a 20-member cabinet. It worked before. He has got, on top of the 35-member cabinet, he has got 26 advisors, and he is living in the past. Malawi has reached a consensus that the previous administration, the way they were governing the affairs of this nation, was contrary to their aspirations and goals. He promised, he vowed to Malawians to fix things, to change things.
The president has also directed a reduction of income tax in the new budget with the aim to help workers whose pay has lost value as a result of inflation. And you know, the devaluation of the kwacha. Isn't this going to help cushion the effect of that measure?
By the way, he is the head of state who immediately after assuming the high office, he increased his salary from 5 million to 10 million. That would represent the 100% salary increment. But ever since, if you check, he has never done that to the public service. Now, he is not in opposition. He is in government. What he should have done was to say, immediately tonight, we have raised salaries for the public servants with this margin. But he never said that. He just said, we will consider. We asked him a simple question to say, if you think that the 44% devaluation is the necessary evil, can you tell us, in a form of documentary evidence, complete with figures, what we have benefited from that previous devaluation? It was that one. Another issue is, within the 3 years of his administration, he has made over 49 trips, international trips. When actually this issue pops up, we are told that as a country we are benefiting. Now, the question is, if you are benefiting from his endless global trotting, why is it that our public debt is ballooning? So you notice that we have got a leader that doesn't care if they're dying for the welfare of the vulnerable and marginalized people that are in majority.
Sylvester Namiwa is the Executive Director of the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, or CDEDI. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. A new party has been officially established to participate in Botswana's general election next year. The Botswana Republican Party will be led by its leader and founder, Biggy Butali, to challenge incumbent President Mokgweetsi Masisi in the presidential contest. Butali, a leading member and cabinet minister in the ruling party, resigned from the main opposition party to form the new one after fallout with former President Serete Kama Iyenkama. But critics say the new party divides the opposition, which they argue will make it much easier for the incumbent president to win re-election. For more about the newly established Botswana Republican Party and its electoral prospect, I reach its leader, Biggy Butali.
The main reason why I had to leave the party that I had formed to start a new one is because the former president, Iyenkama, who was a member of my former party, had decided to stand as president against me at the National Congress. And this decision of his caused a lot of instability in the party and a lot of acrimony, such that ever since he made that declaration, things were never quite the same in the party.
But Biggy, reports show that you fought with leaders of the party. You had a court rule in your favor to be the leader of the party. So if elections are just less than 1 year away, why form this new political party?
Our party had quite a huge following. At one time, I believe it was the biggest political party in the country. And now when this acrimony started taking place, a lot of the members felt discouraged and some wanted to go back to the ruling party. Others wanted to join other opposition parties, but a great majority of them felt that they still had confidence in my leadership and therefore pushed very hard that we start this new party. And I felt obligated to listen to the voice of the people and also taking cognizance of the fact that I felt that I had something to offer. Now, it's true, we are just less than 1 year away from the general elections, 11 months to be precise. But what can we do? We formed the Patriotic Front 3 months before the 2019 elections. But now we have 11 months. I think we have enough time to do well.
But what do you say to your critics who are saying that the ruling party planted you in the opposition to cause confusion, and now that your assignment is done, they are the same people funding you as an opposition party to divide the opposition front that will make the ruling party have an easy win in next year's general election? How do you respond to that?
Peter, I came from the ruling party. I was a minister in the ruling party. I had ambitions of, high office in the ruling party. It's much easier in Africa to be a member of the ruling party, to be a minister. Much, much easier. To join the opposition in Africa is difficult. You sentence your family and yourself to economic hardship, to harassment, you name it. So when I left the ruling party, I wasn't leaving the ruling party to get into K&N. I knew exactly what I was doing and what I was getting into. Now, the sacrifices I had made, if I wanted to go back to luxury, I just joined the ruling party, get a seat, get back into cabinet, and maybe challenge for presidency sometime in the future. That is the easier route.
But realistically, what do you think are the true prospects of your party 11 months to the elections? Don't you think that the opposition front is divided with this new political party, since you said your former party is the biggest opposition party in Botswana?
It was, Peter. It no longer is. But having said that, the ruling party has never been weaker. I don't see the ruling party getting an outright majority in 2024. I see a hung parliament that will require a coalition government. And therefore, I'm confident that we will form the next government.
Biggy Butali is the leader and founder of the Botswana Republican Party. He spoke with me from the Botswana capital, Gaborone. In Liberia, former vice president and main opposition leader from the Unity Party, Joseph Boakai, is the president-elect. This after the Electoral Commission declared him winner of the runoff election. Boakai garnered 50.9%, while incumbent President George Weah got 49.1% of the total vote cast. Boakai's victory makes Weah a one-term president. Addressing the nation after conceding defeat, President Weah extended an olive branch to the president-elect. He promised to work with him to reconcile the country following months of campaigning in the run-up to the first vote and the runoff polls. For more reaction about the outcome of the just-ended contest and what the president-elect plans to do, I reach Mohammed Ali. He is the Secretary General of the Unity Party.
We were sitting with former Vice President, now President-elect Joseph Boakai. And about an hour, 30 minutes after the results were released, he received a call from President Weah, and that was a defining moment for our country's history. That was a defining moment for our democracy, given that there was this huge, anxiety. Many people had thought that there was going to be violence, that the president was not going to accept the results. There was a huge presence of security in the streets prior to the announcement of the results. And so that just calmed the entire country. And after he congratulated the president-elect, he went on in the night to address the nation. In a 4-minute address, he called on everybody to remain calm. He stated that, yes, his party has lost the election, but Liberia has won, and that we should do everything to protect our democracy. Importantly, he also offered to work with the president-elect, to reconcile the country.
Does this set the stage for the president-elect to make the effort to unite the country, since the outgoing president, President Weah, has offered an olive branch, willing to work with him to unite the country?
I think it sets the stage, and that was one of the cardinal things that is needed to begin the reconciliation and the healing of the country after this bruising 3 months of campaign and electoral period. So yes, it sets the stage, and I believe the president-elect is going to work with President Weah. He has always proven to be someone who loves this country, And so working with him will set the stage. It will bring the two factions together, because when you go through the elections result, you realize that the votes were divided basically on regional lines. So it sets the stage, and I believe President-elect Joseph Boakai should jump at that opportunity immediately to begin to reconcile the country.
So what will be his first point of call? You start with him, and when he was declared president-elect, what does he want to do within the first 100 days in office?
There are lots of things that need to be done, and you have to look at the demand of the electorate. The first thing in the first 100 days is to begin the reconciliation process, like we've been talking. But on the economic front, the transitional thing needs to understand what we are inheriting in terms of the economy. And also, the public demand is that there should be some form of audit of the current government. Because if we want to fight corruption, then we need to set the stage by demanding audit of the current government, audit of the entire system, to know what is wrong in order to put into place measures that will curtail corruption in the country. Then the other cardinal part is the movement about we need to set up to face our rules. The accessibility of certain parts of the country is so much difficult. People do not move around easily. And that is a problem for Liberia. So particularly the roads connecting the southeast, we need to do that. And also in this first 100 days, we need to set the tone for investment in the country. We need to begin to make the economy good for people to begin to come in to attract investment. Those are some of the things we need to do in the first 100 days.
Mohammed Ali is the Secretary General of the Unity Party. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of the Nightline Africa program, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Senegal's Supreme Court on Friday overturned a judgment that had put detained political opponent Ousmane Sonko back in the 2024 presidential race, adding that the case will be retried. Last month, a court in the southern city of Ziguinchor, where he is the mayor, had ordered Sonko's reinstatement on the electoral list after authorities removed him. The Supreme Court overturned and annulled that decision and returned the case to the High Court for a retrial. Separately, a West African regional court backed the government of Senegal in a legal battle with Sonko, who had filed a case claiming the state violated his human rights. Sonko, 49, has faced a flurry of court cases over the past 2 years for charges including libel and rape, which he denies. For more, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached reporter Alpha Jallo, who was at the Supreme Court in Dakar.
It was a very heated Friday in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, as embattled opposition leader Ousmane Sonko awaits two landmark court rulings from the ECOWAS court and the country's Supreme Court. In its ruling, the West African Regional Court, ECOWAS, backed the government of Senegal in a legal battle with jail opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, who had filed a case claiming the state violated his human rights. The ECOWAS court had ruled that Sonko's human rights has not been violated by the Senegalese state. Immediately this verdict dropped, there were some reactions from Sonko's supporters and some of his lawyers in the pages of Maître Claire Sredor Lee, who said that he was very disappointed with the ECOWAS ruling. And this will only show that, countries that had dictators, as he described Senegal, will also take the same opportunity in future, so that whenever a case like this reach the ECOWAS court, they will say that, well, the same favor was given to Senegal. So he said that he was disappointed. And in fact, after the ruling, there were people, some angry supporters of Sonko, and there were some running battles. But then the most important, the moment that everybody was waiting for was the ruling from the country Supreme Court. So everybody was thinking, because even before the ruling, the opposition coalition party, in which Mr. Sonko is a member, they held a press briefing, and they said that they hope that, the country's judges would, just rule, fairly. But the other court ruling also at the Supreme Court has not gone well with, Sonko's supporters and the lawyers, because the Supreme Court judge, rejects and annulled the ruling from the Sikansol Tribunal last month, which ruled that Mr. Sonko should be reinstated in the election list and be allowed to collect nomination papers. So you see that, Douglas, there was a lot of reaction everywhere. So initially, people thought that maybe the ruling was in favor of Sonko, and there were some dancing, some people, and there are some cars were holding their horns everywhere. But later, I think when the ruling was announced by different media outlets, so people knew that the Supreme Court saying that the matter has to be sent to the Dakar Tribunal, which is an apex court. That is where they are going to go and see how best, this case or this legal battle between Mr. Sonko and the state would end.
Alpha Jallo is a reporter. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. In Togo, a leading human rights lawyer says the imprisonment of two journalists signals a clampdown on free speech in the West African country. Andre Kanyi Afanu also expressed concern that the democratic space is shrinking following what he says is the recent crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. His remarks come after two journalists, Anani Sasu, a freelance reporter, and newspaper editor Loic Lawson, were imprisoned. They are accused of defaming a senior public official on social media. Human rights defenders and civil society have condemned the imprisonment, saying it sends a chilling message to all activists and opponents of the administration. For analysis and impact of the imprisonment, I reach human rights lawyer Andre Kanye Afanu.
Each time a journalist, a human rights defender, or even a political opponent supposed to be criticizing the government is brought into jail, it is something that is not good. It is something that we should not encourage. So my first reaction is that it is a pity that this issue brought the two journalists in prison. I think the kind of signal given when it comes to those journalists that have been arrested is not a good signal. But when we consider the facts, nobody is no more sure that the amount that was given is really that amount. We noticed that even the two journalists, before they were arrested, they corrected what they have said previously. So my concern is, first of all, there is a need in our country to have a judiciary system which will inspire confidence to the citizens, either government side or citizen side.
Is there a reason to be concerned that this will intimidate people or journalists from covering issues of national importance?
For sure. You know, apart from these, there was a previous affair that brought journalists into prison. And the bad thing is that even one of those journalists died after he was released. If we consider the general situation, I think there is a need to be fearful about the civic space. Yes, in fact, human rights defenders, journalists seem to be free, but it's like those kind of things intimidate people and prevent them from expressing their views.
What do you say to critics of journalists who say that the journalists should have been more careful, they should have been more professional? What do you say to that?
I think they are right. Because, you know, the kind of democracy we want for our countries need responsibility from everybody. Even me, as a human rights defender, there is a need for me, you know, to respect institutions and to be very professional. Even the being professional is a way of protecting the one who is doing his work. Even you there as a journalist, if in your work you are professional and somebody wants something like arresting you or something like that, those who want to defend you will have good arguments so that they will defend you. So I think there is also a need in our country and in other West African countries for human rights defenders, for journalists, to be more professional, to be more careful, so that those kind of negative situation will not occur.
There are also concerns that the democratic space and the space for freedom of speech could be narrowed following some of these imprisonments, because they argue that this is not the first time journalists are being targeted or being jailed for something they have written or spoken about on social media platforms. Your take?
I'm also concerned about that, because there is a trend. You know, if you take, for example, freedom of demonstration, some years ago, when people do not agree with the government, they have opportunity to make demonstration, and then the government will know that people don't agree. But now in our country, some, I will even say for months and years, it's no more possible to have demonstration, peaceful demonstration in my country. And that's not good for democracy.
Andre Kanyafanu is a leading human rights lawyer. He spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. A Ugandan lawmaker says parliamentarians from the opposition will not be deterred in the effort to reinstate constitutional term and age limits. Francis Zaki says they have been vindicated following a recent poll by the firm Hachai Consul Limited that shows over 70% of Ugandans want both mandates reinstated. Presidential term limits were removed in 2005, while age limits were removed in 2017. For more on the research and response from the opposition, I reach parliamentarian Francis Zaki.
Ugandans have never been in support of the removal of the age limit and the age limit. Actually, we've always been sent to our voters, to the population, to ask for their views about that same matter. Even from the time when it has been scrapped off, we asked for their views. Ugandans have always been against the removal of the age limit. So that survey has well represented the voice of all Ugandans in the country, because they have always been against the scrapping of the age limit and also, most importantly, the term limit. So if that survey has come out, let it serve as an example to the government that people are really, really, really tired of the kind of manipulation that has been done to our constitution. So this is the time for them to listen to the voice of Ugandans to make sure that term limits are reinstated, and I will be among the first people to support that.
But Francis, a section of Ugandans are saying that parliamentarians, a majority of parliamentarians, voted for the removal of both the age and the term limit. And majority rules, they said, in democracy. So crying foul of a legitimate action taken in parliament is the way to go. If the opposition has the majority, then they can reinstate the constitutional term and age limit in the constitution. How do you respond to that?
First and foremost, my brother, what you have to understand, that there is what they call political prostitution in Uganda. That whenever such controversial bills come up in the parliament, money will begin moving from one hand to another. That bribery will be on top of the day. Bribery will be moving, money will be, you know, exchanging hands from one NRM MP to another. And that's how such bills pass. You know, That's how the term limit was scrapped off out of the constitution. And that's how it was done, still in the age limit. When some of us were beaten, some of us were tortured, they used all matters of threats, just like how you're seeing right now what's happening in Parliament, that we are against the abduction of our people, the missing people. We are asking or demanding for the government to give us our people. But what's happening in Parliament, that the Speaker of Parliament, she is intimidating and threatening the MPs that she's going to throw us out of Parliament. And that's what exactly happens whenever such bills come up. So it's not just even about the numbers, but the threat, the bribery, and all manners of kinds that they put the fear in the population so that they do not assert their voices. That's what exactly happened.
NRM supporters are saying that the research was an attempt to make the government unpopular or defame the ruling party. What is your reaction to that?
That's what has always been said by the NRM people. That's what they have always been indicating, that such reports, they are, you know, misguiding the people. They are throwing bad light on the government. But when you get down to the people, the views of Ugandans are totally different from what the leaders of NRM say. So what should be done? Let such surveys get into the people. Such surveys, whenever they get into the people will always say the truth. But whenever you get to the leaders, of course, they will always try to sugarcoat things to make sure that at least the truth doesn't get to be known internationally. That's what happens, my brother.
So do you see the will of the majority of the people about the reinstatement of the age and term limit happening anytime soon?
Well, first and foremost, what I will tell you that whatever Mr. Museveni is not interested in, that's what the NRM MPs will make sure that they side with what Museveni has to say. That's what the NRM people will do. But the population, they will always insist that this is what we want. But whenever money comes in the population, you know, people begin speaking in tongues and that kind. But this time, things have changed. Now there is a people power movement led by my president, Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, who won the election, but they announced different results. But now what we have to do as the movement of my party, as the party, National Unity Platform, we are just going to make sure that we put up a very, very spirited fight. We mobilize all Ugandans to make sure that at least that we have it in our constitution. If it doesn't work, at least we shall have put it on record that Ugandans put up a spirited fight against the manipulation of our constitution.
Francis Zaake is a Ugandan parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Before you make me my mama, you wanna make you my baby mama. You really make me wanna love it and you do that baka baka. She don't roll in her body, she make me wanna give it everything, mama see papa see do. And everything about her smiling face, I confess, she captivating my mind. Me say me check her body, she me strip me with a bigger body. Me wanna make it evergreen, my baby fresh and evergreen. She a ice calypso, my lando. To the matter, to the matter, to the matter. She a ice maganda, shaku shaku wo. To the matter, to the matter, to the matter. You give me that feeling, when I go and do this, me love it and you love it. You got me feeling high, baby, don't do me wrong, you're not gonna do me wrong. Baby sing like Rihanna, the way she designer. She's a killer product, Gucci Cabana. Nah, nah, nah. A lot of people want your body. I know a lot of them are acting funny. Some say that they want you, they know that we need you. Can't live life without you. So give it to me early in the morning when you see me, see me. Breakfast in bed, do me, do me. I go to you from Lagos, we go to Kampala. She a dance calypso, my land. Give me that feeling, I bring it on.
She must treat me with a bigger body. Me wanna make it evergreen. My baby fresh and evergreen.
She make me walk down dance to the tempo and to the beat like slow.
Antonio Kima.
Aye, mama. Aye, mama. Tonyo Kima no be wife. Aye, mama. Aye, mama. Tonyo Kima no be wife. If you want to marry you, marry better way. No marry you, Kima. If you want to marry you, marry better way. No marry Jangala. If you want to marry you, marry better way. But she know how you dey feel. If you want to marry you, marry better way. But she know where you no get money. If you marry you, Kima. When money no day, she go back a lot to go. No matter what you give her, she no go appreciate you. Time you Kima. Even I get smoke worry, she go begin call mama. She go begin call papa. She go there shout, I don't die, yo mama. She go there shout, I don't die, yo papa. Obi don't tibo when me, mama. Obi don't tibo when me, papa. If he marry better wife, when money no there, she go there better husband. She go there tell her husband, say make him no worry, say money they come. Anything you give her, she go take and manage you. I be better wife. If you not get smoke worry, she go sing a good song. When go make you happy. Better wife not God the giver. Better wife you know easy to see. Everyone you not put the ananya. Ah, aye mama. Aye mama. Aye mama. Aye mama oh. Omo bi dia, ezi wa malobin yakele, ezi wa malobin lele wo, ezi wa malobin biya yiremo omo bi dia, omo male, wakita. Check my brother. Not the family, oh. Know her baby. Before you go for their bikini, oh. Na snake, they boss snake, yo. Na snake, they boss snake, yo. Brother, na snake, they boss snake, yo. Yezi wa bona come in one. Yezi wa bona mumu dema. Yezi wa bona food.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer David Greenberg, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Kimbo, where to God?